KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
And welcome in the listeners from KPTZ for our weekly COVID-19 update with our health officer and Department of Emergency Management Director. So welcome, KPTZ listeners. I guess we're still a little early, so I don't know. Dr. Locke, do you have a non-COVID anecdote you want to share? You're unmuted.
It shows unmuted on my side here. Well, like yourself, I enjoyed this lovely weekend, both mountain biking and as I'll report, I took a trip to Port Townsend, and we, my girlfriend Jeanette and I walked around, and we did our own survey of Port Townsend and the stores and the grocery stores. So I'll report on that very unscientific survey.
Take it away. Welcome to the listeners of KPTZ, and I'd love to hear what you have to say, Dr. Locke. It's all yours.
Okay. Well, thank you, and good morning to everyone. To start with, the United States, the national news is certainly no better. Most of the states that surged dramatically have now leveled off. As you would expect, when things get really bad, people get serious and they start changing their behaviors. But that's not the same as a comprehensive control plan. And unfortunately now, COVID-19 is moving into those areas of the United States that previously were minimally impacted. So the Midwest and the rural areas of the country are now have some of the fastest growing case rates. And the numbers are really dramatic in the U.S. We're now approaching 160,000 deaths from COVID-19. The projections at our current trajectory are that we will hit 300,000 deaths by the end of this calendar year. And hopefully that will not come to pass. Hopefully we will change our trajectory from what it is now. But that's the path we're on. And we currently have 1/4 of the COVID-19 cases in the world are occurring in the United States, or have occurred. And in the United States, we have 5% of the world population. So that's the national picture. Here in Washington State, things also are leveling off. There's data lag, so we're not absolutely sure. But the modeling studies from the Institute of Disease Modeling, they show that the reproduction number has dropped below 1 in eastern Washington. It's still above 1 in western Washington. However, that data is pretty old. That data only goes to the middle of July. So we have an additional 3 weeks. And what we're especially looking at is this, what's happened since the governor announced new restrictions. We're hoping that's going to be what it takes to really drop the rate in western Washington as well. As I heard Commissioner Dean report, we currently have one of the lowest rates in Washington State, and that's been holding for some time. So Jefferson County is holding at a total of 54 cases, only one of those in the last week. And so it's now becoming popular to report rates based on 100,000, either for the past week or the past 2 weeks. But by most measures, we have one of the lowest rates in the region, and unfortunately, in contrast to our neighbors in Clallam and Kitsap County. So, in the last week, Clallam County has had 26 new cases. So that's brought them up to 120 cases totally, which actually per capita is about the same as Jefferson County. So Jefferson County actually had a higher per capita rate until very recently, because we had a big surge in March and April, much more so than Clallam. And now, in effect, and in some ways, unfortunately, Clallam County is caught up on a per capita basis. Kitsap County has really been wrestling with outbreaks. They had 94 cases in the last week, and that brings them up to a total of 739. This is worrisome to be sandwiched between two counties with high outbreak activity. I'm honestly not sure why our rates are so low. I like to emphasize the positive that we have a very high functioning healthcare system. I think Jefferson Healthcare is doing a great job of testing. I think our staff and our nurse investigators are some of the best in the state. And most importantly of all, my hat's off to the citizens of Jefferson County. We don't get low rates like this without people really taking this problem seriously and making all these behavioral changes. So definitely give credit for everyone who's working to control this pandemic. But there's an element of luck involved too, or there's an element of circumstances that are beyond our control. And so the more activity we have going on in Western Washington, the higher the risk is that we're going to import cases into Jefferson County and have outbreaks here. Along these lines, there's been a lot of discussion among the health officers that our sort of voluntary compliance approach is just not enough. We're getting a lot of good compliance, but we need to get into the 95 plus percent rate to really get this under control. And so we've been talking at the state level more and more about enforcement. And especially given the fact we're seeing this pattern over and over again, that we have outbreaks, people get serious, but then as soon as they think the threat has diminished, they slack off again and start getting together with friends and having parties and taking risks, and then the cycle just repeats itself. So we're recognizing more and more there has to be an infection or a enforcement component to it. I mentioned that I tried to check out what's going on in Port Townsend myself. So we took a trip, kind of a walking tour all over the city this weekend. And by and large, I was impressed how many stores have their no masks, no services signs up and are not only very strict about masking requirements, but also occupancy, just controlling the number of people in the stores at the same time. And so I also noticed that it looked like most visitors were wearing masks as they strolled about the streets, which was really good to see. It was by no means universal, but more than I was expecting. So I think a lot of people are getting it. But we saw people without masks. We saw people with face shields, which I'll get to in a moment. And there's still plenty of room for improvement, still issues with social distancing. So this is really going to be a long-term struggle. And along these lines, what I'm announcing today is I've been working the last couple weeks and with the very able and much appreciated assistance of Mr. Hunsucker, working on a new health officer order that is specifically targeted to food service establishments, and I kind of follows in the lead of King County, that's done this successfully, that's used the fact that health departments have a special relationship with food service establishments, grocery stores, restaurants, convenience stores. Anyone who sells food is licensed by a local health department. And what King County has done and what we're going to do here in Jefferson County is link compliance with all the governors and the Secretary of Health and the local health officers' COVID-19 prevention strategies. Those will now be linked to your food service establishment license. And potentially, if we receive complaints or as a result of our inspections, we see non-compliance, and if after we've tried to work with the businesses in good faith and get them into compliance, they just fail to do it, their license can be on the line. And that's a pretty heavy enforcement tool. I'm also making it extremely clear in this new health officer's order that face shields are not the same thing as face masks. And I received a question on this from a KPTZ listener asking to comment on how good face shields are for source control. And that's exactly the issue. They are not good for source control. The major benefit of a mask is that it traps the respiratory droplets and aerosols that we emit when we talk or cough or laugh or shout. And face shields simply don't do this. They may deflect that stream a little bit, but that's it. So the bottom line with face shields are great if you use them along with the mask. Face shields are really a kind of eye protection. And so if you, and virus getting into your eyes is an issue. So if you want to wear a face shield, in order to be in compliance with the rules, both occupational and in terms of the individual mandate for face masking, you have to wear a face shield along with a mask. People have somehow gotten this idea that you can use a face shield instead of a mask. If you have a medical exemption, that allows you to use a face shield at work. Or if you choose to wear a face shield into a grocery store as a consumer, that's the same thing as a mask. And it's not legally pretty clear to me in the labor and industry regulations that a face shield cannot be substituted for a mask. But that's something we really need to clamp down on, because people, a super spreader, that is to say a person who's infected with the virus but doesn't know it and is spreading the virus, if they're wearing a face shield, they're essentially broadcasting that virus out in public. That's something that we can stop, and in this new health order, that will be addressed, and hopefully we'll see fairly rapid compliance with that. Is face shields will start disappearing from grocery stores and those kind of settings, unless people want to wear them along with masks.
That's something that we can stop, and in this new health laws order, that will be addressed.
Darren, can you mute that phone?
Face shields will start disappearing from grocery stores.
Okay.
And I'm sorry. Freezing up.
I'll mute her. I muted her then.
Okay, we good?
Back to you, Dr. Locke.
Okay. So this will be coming out later today. I'm still receiving a few comments on it. It'll also review the various misdemeanor criminal penalties that are out there as well. Those penalties are actually attached to the governor's proclamation, to the Secretary of Health's orders, and it is and has always been a misdemeanor violation to violate an order of a local health officer. One of the reasons I think it's so important to get serious about this is that we're moving into this next phase. We're really trying to reopen schools. It's critically important to the education of students, but it's going to be extraordinarily difficult. The more activity we're seeing of COVID-19 in the community, the harder it is, it's going to be to keep schools open, because the more prevalent this is in the community, the more likely it is to be imported into the schools, either via students or teachers, and the more outbreaks we're going to get in the schools. We're also trying to maintain at least the current level of economic activity, and with the prospect of hopefully one day moving more into phase 3 type activities. But to do that and not have that trigger a resurgence of infection, it's going to take us doing everything we possibly can to control this. And of course, there's also the issue of preventing medical surge and preventing deaths. You know, all of this depends on a unified effort. So again, I want to thank everyone who is on board with this. But for those who don't, for those who thought they could just keep their heads down and either ignore this or in some cases openly defy it, time's up on that. If you're not going to voluntarily comply, there has to be some kind of penalty for that.
Again, I'm muted, Dr. Locke.
Oh, okay. It seems to do that on its own from time to time. So moving to the KPTZ questions, the first one had to do, it was a question about these hybrid models for schools and how that works. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail because it can get pretty complicated. But basically, the hybrid model, the notion of it is you shrink the class size by one half, and those students all stay together in what's known as a cohort. So those, say, 15 students don't mix with any other 15 students in school, and they're only in school half as often. So they're only there, even less than half, they're only there 2 days a week instead of 5 days a week. So those things combine together, smaller class sizes, more spread out, less contact among students, less time in person at school, actually creates a dramatically reduced risk of transmission, 75% or greater. So it's the science of it is very solid. It's actually been done successfully in some other countries. So it's not entirely theoretical.
Dr. Locke, I think the question is more pertinent, like, if my kid's at school with 15 other people, can they still have a play date with those five outside of household family members during the week?
Right. So that hybrid model is all about that, you know, trying to reduce the exposure among students. Anytime you add on extracurricular or play dates or mixing of cohorts, you're kind of working against the benefits of the hybrid model. So all of those things impose extra risk. And whether the schools are actually going to allow it or not, I don't know. But all of those extracurricular activities, increased socializing among students, as desirable as that might be for other reasons, reduces the benefit of the hybrid model. And sometimes very substantially. So it's just an unfortunate reality of this pandemic is in order to keep schools open, we are going to have to do some very restrictive things. Maybe if we find that we've overshot the mark, we could back off a bit as school progresses. But I don't think, unfortunately, that's going to be the case based on the experience of other countries. So we're going to have to play this very strictly if we want it to work, including limiting some of those very desirable extracurricular educational opportunities or figuring out how to do them in a more remote, distancing kind of way. I think I answered the question of source control and masking. There was a question about the research of outdoors was 19 times lower risk than indoors for contagion. I looked that up. That figure actually came from a Japanese study, as I tracked it down. It was 110 cases, 11 clusters, and they found an 18.7% reduction, or 18.7 times reduction. And that study has been replicated in a number of different settings. So we're pretty confident about that, that the difference, the substantial difference indoors versus outdoors. And probably the most dramatic evidence of this is the racial justice protests that started up in late May and continue today. We have studied that over and over again, and we are just not seeing outbreaks connected to those. And we think it's because they're outdoors, people are on the move, and people predominantly are masking in those settings. So that's the good news of this. In fact, you know, some people have gone so far as to say it's outdoors is what will save us in this. The more we can do outdoors, the more we are going to prevent transmission. A kind of interesting question about long-term side effects of in people who have recovered from COVID-19, and that is a real issue. You know, even though the survival rate for COVID-19 is very high, fortunately, over 99% of people survive, that doesn't mean you're unaffected by it. And we're still learning about this. We know that the virus can attack blood vessels and heart muscle and leave lasting effects. It can cause what appears to be at least long-lasting kidney damage. We can't call any of this this damage permanent at this point because we're only 7 months into the pandemic. So we're hopeful that people who have residual damage can heal. And then it also mentioned in the question something that's very pertinent is sometimes our medical therapies cause damage. So being on a ventilator for days or weeks at a time is something that in and of itself can harm you. The ventilator can damage your lungs. You can get infections on the ventilator. You can get other complications. Commissioner Sullivan.
Yes, I'm thinking back to our conversation about schools. And I was just reading that 97 children have been tested positive the last 2 weeks of July. And thinking about the long-term effects on them, considering their developmental stage, it's probably very premature to know how they'll be affected in the future.
And indeed, we know of this multi-system inflammatory condition is now a very much a recognized childhood complication. That occurs in adolescence as well. It can be even more severe than young children. This is a very serious disease with the potential for long-term complications. On the positive side, we're getting better month by month at treating this. So ventilator survival rates are going up dramatically. We now have kind of standardized treatments for people who are hospitalized, where they're put on anticoagulants and corticosteroids and this antiviral drug remdesivir, if it's available, and the plasma from people who are convalescent from COVID-19. So we have more and more treatments available. The survival rate's going up, but I think that's a very important thing to emphasize, is that you can have permanent damage from this infection. Next question is, and it's come up before, why are fewer tests recorded on the Washington State dashboard than local? This is a problem between the labs and the state that we've been unable to solve. And the state, you know, continues to have problems with, you know, we have a good reporting system for positives, but the 95% of tests that are done in the state that come back negative, it's hard to get all of those into the state reporting system. It's an obligation of the labs to report it to the state, but it doesn't always work, and it's certainly not working for Jefferson County. So the state data on negative tests is really not accurate compared to our local data. We believe our the Jefferson County Public Health website, this is very accurate because we get this directly from the hospital, and the hospital is doing virtually 100% of the tests in Jefferson County. Jefferson Healthcare is doing that. So if people want to know the accurate data on that, you should go to the county website on this. And hopefully the state will figure out how to reconcile these things in the future. But right now it's not completely accurate. The positive case data on the state website is accurate, but not the negative. And then just two more questions. One asks, thinking ahead to influenza season and getting vaccinated, and expressing some concerns about having to wait at pharmacies or in clinics to get the vaccine, and, you know, might there be something else available, like drive-through or outdoor clinics? And I have to say, I haven't heard any discussion of that up to this point. It's not out of the question if we could identify enough demand for it. But right now our focus is to try to keep the vaccination setting safe. So whether you go to a pharmacy or whether you go to a clinic, you know, we feel as long as you're observing the masking and the hand washing and the distancing, you can be confident that you can safely get an influenza vaccination. And I strongly encourage it this year. The last thing you need, along with the COVID-19 risk, is the risk of influenza. We're hoping that all of the things we're doing to prevent COVID-19 will also make for a mild flu and common cold year, because all of these things we're doing also prevent other respiratory virus infections. But we still recommend everyone get a flu shot, and we're making a special push for children to get vaccinated. We don't have the childhood flu vaccine in stock yet. We usually get it at the very end of August or sometimes early September. But as soon as we get it, you know, we're going to be making a big push, especially for school-aged children, to get flu vaccination this year. And then finally, a question about outdoor classes. Are these being considered? I actually know that several of the private schools in Jefferson County are going with outdoor classes. They have much smaller class sizes, and they're able to accommodate it. The public schools, I've not heard of that they're able to accommodate outdoor classes at this size or at this time. But it's definitely something that's being used around the country. It's been used in Europe, including in winter months. Some of the countries that kept their schools open back in February and March did so by having the classes outdoors. So I you know, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, there is a safety factor in that. And anything you can do outdoors is fundamentally safer than doing it indoors, but it's not always possible. So I think that the schools are definitely trying to do the best they can with their whatever facility limitations they have. Commissioner Dean.
Yeah, I'll chime in, having been involved in Port Townsend schools in these discussions, and they're certainly looking at every outdoor space they have available and how to purpose it accordingly. And that might be, you know, for lunch times and other times throughout the day, but I'm definitely looking for ways to get kids outside. I think in part the feeling that, not getting a break from mask usage in a long day is going to be really challenging. And, you know, not that people are going to be running around without masks for, you know, portions of the day, but at least to have a few minutes to be able to take a mask off distance and get some fresh air. So I know that they're looking for additional shelters, using non-school property for classes as well. So I think there's going to be a lot of creative use of space in the school districts.
Yeah. I think of the Norwegian saying that there's no cold weather, just inappropriate clothing. One thing is, as you're talking through this, I go back to what Greg was saying about the groups outside of school. With children in class just partially for 2 days, and that's a situation we can have more control over. If it's dependent on control outside the classroom, that seems really problematic. I don't know if there's a question there.
Oh, right, and I'm sorry, I caught most of that. I just lost my audio connection for a couple seconds there, so I missed part of that. But these kind of control strategies, I think they will evolve over the course of the year too. You know, if we're finding that things are not working, we're going to have to try different strategies. But there's been an extraordinary amount of work that's gone into this at a state level to try to come up with at least the best models, the best guidelines, the best response plans that we can. And so, I think we're at a good place for starting, but ultimately these things that depend on the outcomes you get. And so if it works, we'll stick with our starting plan. If it doesn't, we'll alter that plan.
I'm curious, are there schools that are opening successfully right now? We hear certainly in the media about the ones that aren't going well, including Israel. But are you hearing about schools that opened in a earlier timeline that are able to contain the disease so far?
The only ones I'm hearing are actually in other countries. The news I'm getting in the U.S. is not looking favorable. But as we all know, that this U.S. media really focuses on the negative. Hopefully there are those success stories out there, and that we will hear about them, because that's what we want to base this. Not on theory, but on practice. So people who have these successful models, we want to replicate them. And that's, I think, what the folks that we did a lot of this at a state level, and that's what they were really looking at. What is the science on this, and how can we best translate that into Washington State schools? Yeah.
Any other questions? I guess you're done with your presentation. I know we kind of started jumping in there. Any other questions for Dr. Locke? I got a couple quick ones. The governor's office put out new gym rules, and I've heard different interpretations of that 360 square feet, like around a piece of exercise equipment. One is saying you need the square footage, so it's kind of a 6-foot circle around a piece of equipment. that you need to just have one person in. Another is saying you have to be 17 feet away. And I'm wondering if you had an idea which of those is the guidance.
Well, my understanding is it's this, you know, this 300 square foot area around each person. So that's, you know, that's 17 by 17 feet. But it's, you know, it's actually, you know, closer. It's a little over, like, you know, 8.5 feet. I mean, depending on how you draw it. I think the concept of that is it's really about area. Every person who is, you know, vigorously exercising and kind of putting out this plume of droplets and aerosols is doing it in an area that surrounds them. So you have to keep those areas separate from each other. Now, I'm not exactly sure why they went from the six feet to this. I think it was, you know, they haven't really cited the science specifically, but it seems to be a more restrictive stand. They're saying you have to be even more than 6 feet apart. And that I think it also factors in that, you know, if you add up those areas, that will define how many people can be exercising in a given physical space. Although there's other limits on that too, in terms of the, you know, percentage of your capacity. To me, the bottom line on that is, you know, unfortunately, exercising indoors is a risky thing with COVID-19. And you know, as beneficial and desirable as that is as a physical activity, there are real risks of outbreak risks and transmission risks that are associated with it.
Great. And then secondly, you know, we're redoing the masking video that we did with the county. And one thing I was wondering is, how important is not handling a cloth mask? If I have my cloth mask with me throughout the day, I'm putting it on, I'm taking it off. I think initially we were very concerned about fluidic transfer and me touching my mask and touching something else. And I'm wondering if it's if best practice in mask handling still includes not touching the cloth of your mask unless absolutely necessary, or is that not a big deal?
Well, it's only a big deal if you are shedding COVID-19. So if you are, then your mask has a concentrated source of the virus, which in theory you could touch and spread around, and that would be a risk. You know, if you're not infected, there's no risk. But the whole theory of masking is we have to assume that 40% of people spreading the infection or with the infection are asymptomatic, and this super spreader data is just coming out in one study after the other. This whole notion that 10 to 20% of people spread 80% of the infection. So based on that view, it is best that everyone follow best practices, and that is, yeah, don't touch the damp parts of the mask. So hold it by the ear loops or put it in a bag or a purse or something when you're not wearing it. But as a practical matter, if you avoid touching the damp part of the mask, or better still, the best thing to do of all is to sanitize your hands after you take your mask off. That's the two birds with one stone, because you not only disinfect them from anything you've gotten on your hands from the mask, but also all the other things you've touched.
Great. Thank you. And then finally, for me at least, any word from the state on when they might accept phase 3 applications? And I'm wondering how you feel about phase 3 right now, or should we be conservative in anticipation of the school year? I'm just still a month away.
Yeah, we have received no word from the state at all. It's kind of on indefinite hold right now, and certainly not expecting anything during the month of August is kind of what I'm looking
You got muted again, Dr. Locke, sorry. After the month of August, Dr. Locke, we lost you. Dr. Locke. Did we lose him entirely? No? He's offline. Can you guys hear me? I'm still online, aren't I? Okay. well, we seem to have lost Dr. Locke, so we'll give him a chance to come back and continue after August if he can get reconnected.
Yeah, there it looks like it's back.
Okay.
But
your video's not back.
We can hear you, Dr. Locke. We can't see you.
Oh, okay. Well, then, so I'll just finish up on that should phase three reopen, I think we're going to have to revisit that. I anticipate the process is going to require us to start again from square one, you know, health officer's recommendation, a board of health review, county commissioner concurrence. And a lot of things have changed. So we just need to completely revisit the issue. We're not even sure what will be on phase three at the list. But there are at least a few things I think that are worth considering, like libraries and museums, I think are something that can be done pretty safely. And they're not currently allowed. We're not anticipating anything in the next few weeks. I'm not anticipating that this is going to be an issue for the Board of Health in August.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, well, we'll move on to Willie Vince and the DEM and the EOC update. Take it away, Willie.
Yeah, cool. Thank you, Commissioner. So we're still continuing to work on pushing out the very large shipment of cloth masks that we got. A lot of the service providers we worked with the first go around still had a stock they were working on distributing, so there wasn't a huge need for those right away. As you'll recall, those cloth masks are intended for low-income Jefferson County residents, and so we've had a lot of inquiries from folks looking for those masks for their employees, or I'm looking for them for their customers or another group that doesn't meet those requirements. The goal is that eventually those low-income requirements will be lifted because we have a greater stock than what we need to actually push out to our vulnerable population, and we will be able to start supplying them elsewhere. Again, so we got such a large shipment of masks. It's really going to be tough for us to actually distribute them all to the intended population. So for those of you who have reached out and wanted to get a piece of those masks, we'll be in touch with those requirements are lifted. In the meantime, we're going to continue to be creative, look for service organizations and our partners who work with low-income Washingtonians to try to get those masks out to those populations. But we, in the meantime, have a more than sufficient supply of cloth masks here at the EOC. Child masks we're still waiting on. Per the state EOC, those are going to be another 2 to 4 weeks. So that was last week, so now that's a 1 to 3, so we're hoping to see those relatively sooner than later. In the meantime, our mask makers, the group who really in the early onset of the pandemic stepped up when cloth masks were hard to come by, we were looking to save, you know, N95s and other masks for healthcare professionals. They stepped up to actually make masks. They're stepping up again to actually make some smaller child size masks that we're working on. I'm looking at distributing to vulnerable populations, trying to get them in the hands of the people who need those the most right now. Philip.
You're muted. When the state is able to supply child masks, is there a plan to distribute those through the school districts?
Yeah, so we're going to first and foremost work with, because these will be intended for low-income Jefferson County children, just like the first batch was. So we're going to be primarily working with service organizations that work with the low-income population. Obviously, schools, though, have an excellent grasp of that population. They obviously touch that population as well. So we will be working with them Additionally, and our liaison officer, David, is engaging with the schools in their reopening planning and is making sure that their logistical needs are being met. So we'll be
My recollection is between 60% and 80% of children in our local school districts are in free or reduced lunches because of low income.
Commissioner Dean?
You're muted.
Yeah, so the existing adult mask, maybe just a poor connection. The existing adult masks that we have for low income, where can people get those?
So you can get those direct from either us at DEM or Public Health. Contact one of the two offices and we can get you connected directly. Other than that, service organizations like OliCat, Dove House, The Y, all the food banks in the area. For West End residents, there are a couple of organizations out in Forks. For those of you who do business over there, you can see the full list at our website. I think those are the big ones off the top of my head.
And so I think it's confusing for people. They don't know how they should be contacting organizations. So is it a phone call to make a plan to meet someone to get a mask or... I don't think a lot of people wouldn't know how to get one from DEM, so.
Yeah, go ahead, give us a call. You can email us at bcdem@sierra.jefferson.wa.us. Or we prefer that you would call ahead and then set up a meeting, but if you did stop by, we can certainly bring one out to you in the lot if you ring in. So any of those other organizations, again, definitely prefer that you call ahead, go to their website, grab their phone number. And that'd be preferred rather than drop-in. But email or phone, any of the above. Or you go to jeffcoeoc.org to see that full list and see if there's a particular organization that's closer or one that you work with regularly. Something as simple as a phone call.
Thank you.
Child-sized masks, again, we're hoping to get a shipment of those just within a couple of weeks. We don't know exactly how many we're going to be getting at this point in time. We're thinking at least 2,000. But we do know that the state, who they had initially ordered 50,000 and have distributed all of those, they ordered another 300,000 since the demand has been greater than they initially anticipated, especially with schools reopening. So we're hoping for a healthy stock of those. Our planning section team is continuing their mask survey, very similar to the one Dr. Locke himself coordinated this weekend. They've been very content with what they've been seeing. Again, we're at 95% plus almost everywhere they go. They're not seeing a lot of folks completely maskless. It's mostly been either shields or a mask that's being improperly worn, which I've been kind of harping on that for the past couple of weeks. And I really think Dr. Locke's new order will help with that face shield issue. That's been one of the issues you've seen. They wanted to make sure that I remind everyone that they've been noticing out on Water Street, folks who have been outside have been also wearing masks. But there's been a lot of moments where there have been kind of large crowds gathered on the sidewalk, and folks think because they are outside, they no longer have to wear a mask. But if you're unable to maintain that 6 feet of healthy distance, you should be keeping your mask on, even if you're outside walking around. So just a friendly reminder that if you're 6 feet, if you're consistently walking by people on the sidewalk as you're out perusing some of the local businesses downtown, just go ahead and keep your mask on. And then that also would help with the issue regarding touching your mask and potentially contaminating your hand. So that would help there. Philip?
I've got a question for Willie and perhaps Dr. Locke, and that is, I've observed among some people sort of a sense of, hey, this is cool, I'm going to wear my bandana as opposed to really a fitted cloth mat. Dr. Locke, can you speak to that?
Yeah, there are actually now some studies that are coming out that compare the effectiveness of different masks. And typically bandanas are almost at the bottom of the list. They are the second worst form of masking, both in terms of source control and personal protection. So whereas it's legal, it meets the legal criteria, it's the least effective form of mask, a fitted
thing. So in that sense, it's similar to a face shield where the stream of air can bypass the cloth.
Right, exactly. And actually, in one of the recent studies, the worst kind of mask is a knit mask, that it actually is able to break the droplets up into aerosols, so it magnifies the amount of aerosols that you're putting out. So we really want to discourage that. You know, no knit masks. We really discourage bandanas too. That you're not getting, you're not availing yourself of the kind of protection that you can get from a cloth or a surgical type mask, and you're also not, it's not adequate source control. Unless it's, you know, extremely well sealed all the way around, and the bandanas I've seen are not worn that way.
Can you describe what a knit mask is? Because, you know, sometimes a soft jersey fabric is called knit.
My understanding is that it's the fabric type. So it's like a loose weave, very porous fabric, where when you breathe, it just goes right through it, and it ends up. I think it was a surprise to the researchers that it actually magnified the aerosol production. Most simple two-layer cloth masks or three-layer surgical masks are remarkably effective at trapping droplets and aerosols. Like in the 98-99% range.
Okay. Sorry, Willie.
No, not at all. I just have two more things I want to touch on very quickly. We had a couple of calls here at the office last week about folks who, even though we've talked about this before, I just really want to make sure it's abundantly clear to folks that, you know, there are folks out there who can't wear a mask for legitimate reasons. And we had a call specifically from a woman who was very frustrated over the fact that she has anxiety issues and she absolutely cannot wear a mask. And she's been frustrated that she feels like she's been, you know, shunned from participating, going to the grocery store and things like that. And really want to reinforce that there are alternate forms of service available for folks who can't wear a mask. Just because you can't wear a mask, it doesn't give you permission to go inside the store. But a lot of local stores, retail outlets, etc., are willing to kind of meet you in the middle. There's contactless delivery, curbside pickup, all that kind of fun stuff. On Local 2020's website, there is a great resource that has a map and a list of businesses, and has some information about specifically what they offer as an alternate form of service. So I really recommend, even if you are able to wear a mask but are still kind of uncomfortable with going in their capacity, what have you, check out that website and check out that resource. They have a great COVID-19 resource page in general. Specifically that, to kind of learn about what local businesses are doing, especially if you're unable to wear a mask. Last but certainly not least, I will plug once more the All-County Picnic, or the alternate form of the All-County Picnic coming up this weekend. It's Sunday, specifically our presentation is at 5 p.m. This Sunday, the 16th. We're encouraging folks because, again, the All-County Picnic is it's a celebration of community and resilience, and we have almost 1,000 people at H.J. Carroll Park every year. We won't be able to do that. So we're encouraging folks to, quote, picnic in place, have an event out on your front yard, walk around your neighborhood, wave at the other families in your neighborhood kind of from a distance. To support the picnicking, one of the great traditions of the All-County Picnic is the free corn on the cob. You can actually sign up to get uncooked corn delivered to your residence for free on Saturday or Sunday to support your picnicking activities and carry on with that tradition. Then at 5 p.m. we'll have a presentation. I'll be talking about kind of the COVID-19 response thus far, some of our lessons learned. We'll have a few other partners there to talk about what they've learned. And then we'll have a discussion about community and about resilience, especially in the age of COVID-19. And so to sign up for that presentation or to sign up to get your free corn on the cob, you can do that at the Production Alliance at their website.
You just muted.
Which is theproductionalliance.org. And they have a page for all their events. Click on the All County Picnic, and then you can sign up again for your free corn on the cob, and as well as the presentation, as well as some guidance on, you know, kind of what it means to picnic in place and celebrate this new form of the All County Picnic in a safe manner. So I'm looking forward to see you all Sunday afternoon. Excuse me.
Great, thank you. Dr. Locke, can I see you had something to add?
Well, I was just going to underscore what Willie made a very good point about, you know, people who do have medical issues, and as we've done the research, they're predominantly psychological issues. People who have claustrophobia or panic disorders, they have difficulty wearing masks, and we do want to accommodate them in alternate ways. And I would also emphasize that those kind of conditions are treatable. So people who get anxiety with masks can learn to sort of desensitize themselves to that reaction. You know, you start small. You wear the mask for a couple minutes, and then you use it for a longer period of time. And there are programs that you can go through to make yourself more comfortable wearing a mask. A lot of people feel that masks are not comfortable, and that's unfortunate. But it's an essential control strategy for this pandemic, and you know, no matter what the reason that a person can't wear a mask, it's just not safe for an unmasked person to be in a public setting, and that's the reality that we have to deal with. So if people cannot be in those settings, we have to find an alternate way for them to can get the services they need. And for workers who cannot wear masks may be effectively disabled from a kind of work that requires masks.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Locke. Thank you very much, Willie. I'm excited for the virtual all-county picnic. I guess I have to make my own chimichurri, though. Okay, well.
Unfortunately.
It won't be as good, but I'll try. Any questions for Willie today? All right. Once again, you've answered all our questions in your presentation, Willie. Thank you very much. All right. Well, I think that probably takes us to the end of our weekly update, unless there's any last thoughts. No, we'll say thank you, Dr. Locke. Thank you, Willie, for your time and for keeping us up to date on all that is COVID-19 in Jefferson County. So until next week, stay safe and thank you very much.
Thank you all.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19. Live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. And again, thank you for listening.